This Day in Maine is made possible by Now You're Cooking, celebrating 24 years of selling cookware, kitchen tools, gadgets, and fine wine on historic Front Street in downtown Bath, open 7 days a week.
From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Patty White with the news on This Day in Maine, Wednesday, March 27th, 2024. The Maine Senate today gave initial approval to a bill that would limit the number of hospital patients that can be assigned to a single nurse. Supporters say it's aimed at reducing burnout and improving health outcomes. But as Steve Missler reports, the proposal is fiercely opposed by the state's hospital association, which says it's a heavy-handed way to address a nursing shortage and will cost providers millions.
California was the first state to implement nursing ratios more than 20 years ago, and efforts to expand the policy to other states have largely been defeated by hospital associations. But the pandemic has brought forth a new wave of such proposals backed by nursing unions, and the Maine bill is among them. It mandates ranges of nurse-to-patient ratios that depend on the condition of the patient. And its sponsor, Senator Stacey Brenner, a Democrat from Scarborough, says it will encourage the 26,000 licensed nurses in Maine to either stay in their jobs or rejoin the profession.
Maine does not have a shortage of nurses. We have workplace conditions that are unacceptable to nurses.
Opponents, including the Maine Hospital Association, dispute that assertion. They argue that mandating nurse-to-patient ratios will reduce healthcare services and increase costs. The MHA says the bill will cost its hospitals $100 million by requiring the hiring of more nurses, which would be especially difficult for rural hospitals. The Democrat-controlled Senate endorsed the bill 22-13 as Republicans voted as a bloc to oppose it. Additional votes are needed before the bill advances to Governor Janet Mills, who has yet to take a position on it. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
Maine Democrats on the legislature's Judiciary Committee today advanced Governor Janet Mills' bill responding to the state's worst mass shooting in history. The legislation expands background checks on gun purchases to advertise sales online and printed publications, while also creating a network of crisis prevention centers. The bill does not streamline Maine's so-called yellow flag law to make it easier to confiscate someone's firearms, but it does give law enforcement more discretion to take someone into protective custody, a requirement to initiate the confiscation process. All Republicans on the committee opposed the bill, with some arguing that the expanded background checks would lead to a gun registry. Some expressed support for the mental health component. The bill now moves to the full House and Senate for a vote. Workers at the Long Creek Youth Development Center in South Portland say inadequate staffing is creating serious safety problems at the facility. As Susan Sharon reports, they're making their concerns public because they say the Department of Corrections has not taken action to remedy the situation.
In early February, workers represented by the Maine Service Employees Association wrote a letter to the DOC saying the lack of staffing has led to riots at the facility and that residents and staff are persistently placed in harm's way. They made 13 recommendations to address the problems. They called for bolstering staffing levels, creating work schedules that don't rely on 12-hour shifts, and restoration of positions that have been cut over the years. Since then, they say nothing has changed. On average, 28 young people were held at Long Creek each day last year. That's about half the number from just a few years ago. But as of December 1st, there were 30 vacancies for juvenile program workers at Long Creek. Last month, DOC Commissioner Randall Liberty said the department was working hard to recruit additional people, but he said the positions are challenging to fill because of the difficult work environment and forced overtime. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
State regulators have revoked the lodging license for a Motel 6 in Portland currently serving as emergency shelter for asylum seekers. A follow-up inspection found cockroaches and other code violations, and the city now plans to rehouse all 64 families by July 1st. Ari Snyder reports.
The State Department of Health and Human Services revoked the license for nearly all of the hotel's 128 rooms because they were functioning as long-term stays. Following that decision, city inspectors found a cockroach infestation at the hotel. Inspectors also found that 74 occupied rooms were not registered as long-term rentals with the city, another code violation. One former resident, an Angolan asylum seeker who gave her name only as Maria, says the hotel has a long-standing cockroach infestation. Maria says she found the insects in her room and in her infant daughter's crib. Every time I put her in the crib, I found cockroaches there, she says, speaking in French. and I was afraid that the cockroaches could crawl into her ears or her nose. Motel staff declined to answer questions on Wednesday and did not allow a Maine Public reporter to speak with current guests on site. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Ari Snyder.
Three empty courthouse buildings in southern Maine could eventually be redeveloped into affordable housing. The legislature's housing committee voted in support of a new measure earlier this week that would allow the state to convey the properties in York, Sanford, and Biddeford to local housing authorities. Biddeford Housing Authority Executive Director Guy Gagnon says the former courthouse is in good condition and would bring down redevelopment costs for a potential affordable housing project.
We're way ahead of the game on the cost spectrum as far as creating housing there. So that's not something we have happened to us very often. Usually we're redeveloping the worst building in town.
State officials say the three buildings would be transferred for a nominal cost. The state is currently paying about $350,000 a year to maintain the vacant structures. The measure faces further votes in the House and Senate. Maine is receiving more than $23 million in federal funding to support substance use treatment and facilities. $15 million will go to expand the McCulley Residence Program, which provides transitional housing for women and children in Portland. Community Housing of Maine Executive Director Cullen Ryan says the funding will allow the addition of up to 60 additional units in York, Oxford, Hancock, and Aroostook counties.
There is demand out there. There are people who are desperate, and this is going to allow people to just rebuild their lives. And they've wanted to, and there's just been no place for them to turn.
The funding, secured by Republican Senator Susan Collins, will also be used to expand or support residential treatment programs in Biddeford, Saco, Lewiston, and Rockland, and for facilities and equipment at recovery centers in Lincoln and Rumford. New England is set to be coal-free by 2028. Granite Shore Power announced today it would transition the region's last two coal plants, both in New Hampshire, to, quote, renewable energy parks. The owners committed to stop burning coal in a settlement agreement with the Environmental Protection Agency, the Sierra Club, and the Conservation Law Foundation. Tom Irwin is with the Conservation Law Foundation. He says the transition will help fight climate change.
It's a big moment. Coal is the dirtiest form of energy that we have. It's essential to address the climate crisis, that we get off fossil fuels and make that transition to a clean energy economy.
Advocates have called on the company to not use gas to generate power after transitioning. Granite Shore Power said they didn't have immediate plans to use gas, but that they intend to, quote, optimize the grid for reliability, which the company says will require a balanced mix of generation. The newly formed University of Maine Graduate Workers Union is calling on the University of Maine system to negotiate a fair contract and add protections for graduate student workers. As Caitlin Bedayan reports, it's part of a rise in union activity at colleges and universities across the country, where many staffers are demanding better pay and working conditions.
United, we bargain. Divided, we beg.
We're not recognized and respected for the work that we do here.
M. Soles is a fourth-year PhD student in the physics department, where she also works as a research assistant. She's one of many union members at the rally demanding that a range of protections be formalized in the contract, including higher pay. Soles says she made $28,000 last year and has struggled to find housing near campus.
I've, you know, tried to survive the best that I can as a graduate worker, and it is, at times, like, it gets really tight.
A spokesperson for the university system says that administrators greatly value student contributions and are optimistic a contract can be reached that will satisfy both the workers and the university. Graduate student employees aren't alone in their frustrations. The Maine Service Employees Association, which represents staff within the Maine Community College system, picketed outside a Board of Trustees meeting Wednesday. The union's contract expired 8 months ago, and workers are demanding higher wages and a reinstatement of merit wage increases, which were frozen 15 years ago.
And I think it's important that Maine Community College System lead the way in fixing these issues in higher ed.
Katrina Ray Solis is a field representative with the union and an adjunct professor.
I think that this is a chronic issue across higher education, that they're relying more and more on lower wage staff, lower wage faculty. And if we can't lead the way on that, it's a failing system.
This is all part of a rise in union activity at universities across the country, says Michael Hillard, an economics professor in Maine who studies labor movements. Hillard calls it part of a growing movement culture.
We have a strong culture, which you see throughout the labor movement, particularly, but not only with young people right now. You see this kind of willingness to be active.
Hillard points to the University of California system in 2022, when graduate workers went on strike and won major changes in their contract. And the Boston University Graduate Workers Union that went on strike just this week.
So, you know, you just have this kind of overall picture where, you know, there is a recognition that it's not a good economic deal. And so you match that structural reality of like the economics becoming terrible for many of the people involved with the movement culture I've been talking about. And you get a labor movement in higher ed that looks like the auto industry in the 1930s.
For the graduate workers at the University of Maine, including M. Soles, negotiations are approaching their fifth month. But Soles says she and her union colleagues are determined to get a better deal in their contract, not just around pay and benefits, but also the systems for reporting discrimination and harassment.
And I think that the way that we're addressing that is exactly what this entire rally is about, is we're coming together as a collective and showing just how powerful we are.
For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Caitlin Bedayan.
Maine school officials are reporting rising rates of anxiety, depression, and other disorders in students. And to address those challenges, many districts bring in contracted outside mental health clinicians. They spend their days within school buildings alongside teachers and social workers to provide ongoing treatment. But some providers are warning that those services could be at risk as they face financial shortfalls. Robbie Feinberg has more.
Okay, so he chose this mismatched rainbow hodgepodge.
Inside her living room in Brunswick, Rebecca Strasberger scrolls through her phone to show off the very distinctive style of her six-year-old son, Henry. In one photo, he's decked out in rainbow heart light-up sneakers and a rainbow backpack.
I mean, it looked like rainbows threw up on him, and he went into school with the biggest grin on his face, just so happy to be himself.
But Strasberger says Henry also had a hard time sitting still.
He's definitely, you know, he's a body in motion is a phrase that both of his teachers now in public school have used independently of each other. So he's just really full of energy.
And when Henry entered pre-K, his teachers began to notice that that energy was disrupting his learning. He struggled with impulse control, self-confidence, and feelings of isolation, and was prone to emotional outbursts. Henry was diagnosed with ADHD, and now in kindergarten, he meets every Monday morning with an in-school clinician.
His therapist, Hannah, helps him really understand, you know, why he's feeling a certain way and how to think about it and maybe, you know, talk himself up and feel better about himself in those situations.
These types of clinicians are located in hundreds of schools across Maine. They often aren't directly employed by a district, but instead work for a healthcare provider and get reimbursed through insurance. And Holly Blair with the Maine Principals Association says bringing in a qualified clinician, even for just a day or two a week, has filled gaps in mental health services.
So having them on property helped the kids be able to get like their regular check-ins or their regular appointments. But then if there was a crisis moment, you know, they had a clinician right there on property that was able to help step in.
But providers now warn that the funding behind these arrangements isn't enough to pay the real costs of operating them.
We are on target to lose over $1 million in this program this fiscal year. That's over $1 million. That kind of loss is not sustainable.
Jane Van Bramer is the president and CEO of Sweetser, which has clinicians in more than 100 schools across the state. She says while clinicians get reimbursed for each appointment with a student, they're not paid for time spent on other parts of the job, such as meetings with teachers or responding to students in crisis.
What makes the model successful is that our staff and our clinicians are part of this whole blanket that surrounds the child with support. And that interface takes time and energy and attention, yet none of that is billable. Traveling to a child's house, sometimes it's 2 hours away, not billable.
In response, several organizations are pushing for legislation that would appropriate about $1.5 million a year that they say would keep these mental health services afloat. Holly Blair with the Maine Principals Association says that without action to shore up these programs, the mental health crisis affecting Maine youth is only going to get worse.
Educators don't go into, they're not certified social workers, right? They have very limited training versus those that have a social work degree or a guidance counseling degree.
And if we don't have the funding for those services, that's just going to, it's going to be detrimental for schools.
He has calm.
Back at her home in Brunswick, Rebecca Strasberger shows off a feelings dictionary that her son Henry put together at school. Just one tool that he and his school-based therapist have created to help him better handle his emotions. She says the prospect of losing those services is unsettling.
The thought of having to go through that for Henry and for his little brother Connor is a scary one. I hope that this incredible resource stays.
The legislature is expected to determine the fate of any additional funding over the next few weeks as it takes up a supplemental spending package. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. Coming up on Maine Calling at 11 tomorrow morning, Maine women who've made their mark in government, arts, sports, science, conservation, and other fields. I'm Patty White. Thanks for listening.